Hey guys, this is Joao Riquelme, and you're listening to the Tecker Tennis Podcast powered by Genesis Health Clubs.
Well, welcome to today's episode of the podcast. So I got a special guest today. So Joao, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Robert. Very excited to be here with you today. I want to make you a question, Robert, to start. I want to ask you, how many tries did it take you to get my name right?
Well, shoot, I don't know that I've ever gotten it right. So it's so tell us exactly how to pronounce your name.
So it's J-O-A-O.
So Joao.
I know it seems funny, but it's Joao without the L. Normally people say it with L at the end.
So
it's Joao. Yeah.
Got it. Sounds good. Well, thank you for being at the podcast. Let's start today with the this or that. So we'll go quick into these questions. So do you like ad or no ad?
I'm a classic one. I prefer ad, yes.
Gotcha. Most college guys, they'll say no ad, so that's ad. You like ad. Full third set or a match tiebreak?
Full third set, all day.
So you want to be on the court all day.
I want to be on the court as long as it takes.
Did you play ITF as a kid?
I play a few ITF juniors.
So do you like ITF or do you like, in America, USTA?
ITF.
ITF. Yeah. Everybody says that. In doubles, ad or deuce side?
Oof, that's a tough question. I'm going to say at side, even though my backhand is not my weapon shot, but I like to hit forehands inside outs all day. So I'm going to take that side and bomb returns with my forehand.
Well, if you like to hit forehands inside out, that usually means you played on clay as a kid. So do you like clay or hard?
Clay. Clay. I wish we have some red clay courts around, you know, but we got the green clay.
But it's just not the same, is it?
It's never going to be, you know, the same, you know, the being at home, you know, playing in South America on red clay is a special feeling for sure.
Yeah. And so that answers the next one. Inside out or inside in? You already answered that.
Inside out.
That probably answers the next one. Indoor or outdoor?
Outdoor as well. Like all the complications, you know, the wind, the sun. I think the harder it is to play, the better it is for me.
It is for you. So you want it to be full third set with lots of wind and clay, and you want
bad bounces, you know, everything.
On-court coaching or no? Players at any level get on-court coaching.
I think no. I'm going to say no for this one. I like to have somebody, you know, to support me on the outside, you know, but I think tennis is a sport where you have to figure out, you know, the problems and the solutions by yourself. I think that's the beauty of it. But I'm not opposite to having a coach. I think the coach can really, really help, you know, the player to develop and being on the court. I think it's an experience and something that can really improve the player.
As a coach now, would you like to be able to coach the players that you coach while they're in the match?
I think yes. I would like to help the players. As a player in the past, I'm going to say, it's kind of a contradictory, but I think now I would like to be on the court, help my player, you know.
Would you like to see maybe coaching in younger ages and no coaching at older age? I think it's strange to me that the pros are now getting coaching, but an 8-year-old who doesn't even know which side to stand on to hit the ball doesn't get coaching. Does that seem backwards to you?
Oh, that's a really interesting way to see it. I think yeah, you're right. I mean, when you are 20 or 25, you're a professional, you're top 10 in the world, you know. I feel like those guys have been through a lot of different situations and experiences. By then, they should know kind of what to do. But I think at any level, the mind is super important. You know, there's different situations, different emotions that you're going to think and you're going to feel. And definitely it's something interesting. I think it makes more sense, obviously, to have a coach when you are young, you know.
At the high level, the coaches are getting paid so much, you also want to justify what they're getting paid.
Yeah, exactly.
It makes sense. All right, so you win the toss. Do you serve or do you receive?
I like to serve. Yeah, I like to serve.
I've never had somebody say receive.
And this is funny because when I was young, I was very anxious player, you know. So I normally started choosing receive, but just the looking at my opponent bouncing the ball, you know, in the beginning will cause me so much anxiety that will make me want to, you know, like throw up. So I started seeing this and I was like, I don't want to wait, you know, for my opponent to bounce the ball and to serve. I just want to go right away and serve and take control of the rhythm of the match, you know, and serve. It was something that I never told any of my coaches, you know. It will last like one or two games maybe, but I will feel like very, very anxious in the beginning of the matches, and that's why I always chose to serve first.
Yeah, but it's real normal. You know, I played American football, and yeah. There's a saying that you're always nervous till you get hit for the first time. And then once you get hit, it's like, okay, I can settle in, right?
Yeah.
And so you're basically saying the same thing. All right, so let's get into it. So Joao's a coach here at the Tucker Tennis Academy powered by Genesis Health Clubs in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And so, Joao, I just want to hear a little bit about your early upbringing in tennis. How did you start? How young were you? Where are you from? You know, talk about basically from the first racket put in your hands until you got competitive.
Well, everything started on 2003 in Chile. That's where I'm from. I should have never been a tennis player, you know, from because of the family, you know.
Most people in South America say they should be playing soccer.
Player, exactly. So my grandfather was a professional soccer player, played for a national team and played professional soccer as well. My dad was one of the most talented soccer players that I have seen. I saw him scoring goals from middle of the field, you know, live. He didn't get to be a professional because he had to take care of all of us, you know, at a very early age. But yeah, it was just I don't know, destiny. My brother, everything started with my brother living and moving to Switzerland at 18 years old, looking for a better life. And he was working on a company that they helped to move people, you know. So there was stuff that people didn't want. You know, like clothes or shoes, or, and in one of those houses there were a couple of tennis rackets, you know. So my brother used to send all this stuff to Chile, you know, once a month. We'll all get together in the living room, opening this box that will come from Europe, from Switzerland, from my brother. And in one of those boxes, I see two tennis rackets, a Prince racket and a Head racket, you know. And I grabbed them and I asked, you know, like, these are tennis, what are these, you know? And I said to my dad right away, hey, dad, let's go play outside, you know? Let's go play in the backyard. You have a little bit of a space there. And we went there. We started playing on the backyard. And I think the same day after hitting a few balls, I told my dad, or he asked me, and I said, dad, I love this. I want to be a tennis player. And I think that was, I mean, for a family like us, you know, like a low-income family, poor family, you know, where my dad was a musician, you know, and my mom just will take care of us. So playing tennis would be the craziest idea from a kid. But I think my dad took it very well. Instead of saying to me, you know, like, are you crazy? We don't have the money. You know, he started figuring out how we can make that possible. You know, started knocking doors and talking to people. You know, I was a very good student. I was a very good student at a school. So he figured some stuff out. He took me to the Nano Zuleta Tennis Academy in Chile. Nano, if you ever get to listen to this, you know, thank you for everything. He's a former coach of a 9 in the world, Nicolas Massu, also gold medalist. He saw me hitting and he saw that I will never stop moving my feet. And he said, okay, we're going to give your son a scholarship. You know, it's going to be, I still remember, it's going to be $10 back in the time, 2003. And he's going to come once a week, okay? So $10 back in the time for my family was 4 days of work, you know? And yeah, it was a huge effort from my dad, from my mom, from my siblings as well, you know? It's a nice story.
How old were you when that happened?
I was 8 years old.
And so he says $10 one day a week.
One day a week.
And so when did it? At what point did that begin to grow? Because it's hard to get good playing just one day a week. So at what point did they say, "Hey, let's go 2, 3, 4"? And obviously, if $10 equals 4 days of work, yeah. If you want to go 5 days a week, there's not enough days in the month to make $50. So how did that work?
Everything, I think, started with my desire to improve. My dad will take me close to this place, to this club, you know. And by taking me, I mean going in the bus, you know, with me together. He would leave me outside, and then I had to walk a mile to get into this place, you know, as a 9-10 years old. Sometimes people will take me in there, you know, will give me a ride to the club. But everything started with this coach, Nano, started seeing my desire of improving, you know, wanting to be there. Sometimes I would go and I would not have anybody to hit with and to play with, and they will talk about it, you know, and he started saying, okay, come twice a week this time. You're going to pay the same thing, you know, same $10, and let's see how everything goes, you know. So I started getting better and better, you know. At 9, 10, I started going 3 times a week, and by the age of 12, I was going almost every day, you know, especially in the summers. The summer, I will be there every day. They never made me pay more. You know, actually, they stopped charging me, you know, at some point. So that's why I'm always thankful to the academy, to Nano, to Rodrigo Lascano as well. That was my coach when I just started. You know, Nano was traveling with Masu all around the world, you know, with a professional player, top 10. And he was also traveling with other top players, and the person that was there was Rodrigo Lascano. So I share very beautiful moments with him. He helped me to improve a lot, you know. I was the worst one in my age group when I was 8 years old. It was about 4 years going to these tournaments, you know, collecting $5, $10 to go to a tournament, take a bus, go with my dad, and lose 9-0, 6-0, 6-0. And it was, I don't know, my dad always took it in a good way, you know. Even though he was very competitive, he always asked me to just give my 100%. He didn't care about winning or losing. He just wanted to see me competing and fighting and showing, you know, that fire that I had inside. And everything started going better. I had a very good people in my club training with me. Kids that were already number one in 12s. And I started beating them. I started beating them, you know, little by little. It was just my desire. I would just see them. I was like, I need to beat these guys. I want to beat these guys. And I'm going to come every day. I'm going to do whatever it takes. And I'm going to beat them in a mini tennis game. I'm going to beat them in a half court, you know, game, in anything that I have the chance, you know, because they didn't want to play with me sometimes. You know, I was not good. And now we're talking about kids that were 5 in the nation. So I remember this one summer where everything changed. These kids, they all travel to the U.S. They do the academy until today. They do trips. So one of the main trips that they do is they come and play the tournaments in December here, the Eddie Hare, the Orange Bowl, you know, and a few other tournaments. So the entire academy, this group of top kids, you know, came to the U.S. to play these tournaments, and I stay there, of course, you know, no money to do all this. I stay there with Rodrigo, and we did a plan the entire summer. We were doing 600 balls in a row every morning from Monday to Friday or Saturday. And then we will be playing matches, me against him, in the afternoon. It was just both of us, you know. And after that summer, the kids came back, and they could never beat me again, you know. And I jumped from being the worst one in the group at 200 in the nation, you know, in a ranked where you have only 300 kids, to be number one. So I think after that summer of consistency and competition and matches and fun.
How old were you in that summer?
I was 13 years old. 13 years old. And just from one summer to another, everything changed. I think all the work paid off and started showing. And then I became number one in the nation in under 14s. I got my first contract, so I got my first rackets, you know, my Bowler rackets, Pure Drive rackets, and from there everything, you know, started being a different journey, you know. So
yeah, that's a great story. It amazes me that how many stories like that exist in tennis, right? There's a podcast I was listening to the other day, and the guy in the podcast was a head coach in college, and I asked him, I said, how you know, what are some of the commonalities of the best players you've ever coached? And he said they all had somebody who did exactly what was done for you, mm-hmm. right? Somebody who took a liking to them, who took an interest in them, and wanted to help them be successful. But it makes me wonder, you as a coach now, and how easy some of the kids here have it. How does that impact when you think about all you had to go through to become a good player, and you think, man, if you would just give a little effort compared to what I had, you would be so much better. Does that go through your head every once in a while? It'd have to, wouldn't it?
It does, but I also understand that the times are different, the environment is different, the culture is different, everything is different, you know, the position of the kids is different. So I kind of like to understand what they think and what they feel, and maybe little by little start trying to change their mindset, you know, and make them understand that first they got to be grateful for what they have, and second, you know, that if you want to be a great tennis player, you need to put a lot of effort, you need to put a lot of work, and you need to, you do all these things. So I understand them from being, you know, the way they are, because it's obvious you haven't experienced, you know, what I experienced. So you're not going to understand, you know, the way that I see things, of course, but I'm going to try little by little to make you feel, you know, this way, understand these things, and maybe get to change you a little bit, and maybe you create a positive impact, you know, in yourself and how you view things in general.
Well, and then, so then the next question is, do you ever feel like at some point I've got to find a kid that was just like me and give that same, because the tennis culture in the States is a lot different from other countries in the sense that it's almost a find a way to make as much money as possible. And you see a lot of coaches get into this cycle of, I'm just going to make as much money as I can. And there's not a whole lot of space for what you got to experience, because they're all just, you know, every hour is booked. I'm trying to make it, you know, every dollar I can make on the court. So what I see, tell me the two folks that helped you back then, the names of them at the academy?
It's Nano Zuleta and Rodrigo Lascano.
So Nano and Rodrigo, when I hear those two guys, they probably were a little later in their career. Where they weren't young guys, probably 20 to 30. Were they a little bit older, had been through it a little bit?
Nano was already experienced. Back in the time, he was probably around 50 years old.
50, yeah.
Rodrigo was very young. Rodrigo was 23 years old. He started playing tennis at 18.
So you got a good combination of somebody who is experienced and somebody who is young. So you got a little bit of fire from the
exactly.
young player. And then
yes.
you got a little bit of wisdom from the older player. It's just so fluky that it happened for you like it did, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And thankful for Dad that he didn't just say, no, that's crazy. Those are just rackets from your brother, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, my dad, my mom, my siblings, you know, that some days they will have to take me. I remember my sister, you know, she was pregnant, you know, and she took me there. There were some dogs, you know, coming at us. So there's definitely a lot of funny experiences that when you look back, you're like, man, all the things that we had to go through, you know, it's definitely. I always talk about it, you know. When I have the chance to talk to them, I remind them, I tell them those stories, and we have a laugh together. I think that is what is life about, you know, like remembering those moments and knowing where you're coming from, you know, and yeah.
It's just watching you talk about it. It's fun to watch. So tell me, so. 14, up to 14, that's the story. 14 to 18, you said, became very different.
Yes.
So tell us about 14 to 18 and before your college decision, but 14 to 18, what your competition looked like, what if you were traveling, all the sponsorships. Tell us all about that.
14 to 18, it was definitely a very important age for me. I stopped going to Nano Zuleta Tennis Academy. I got a new person, a new angel in my life that came to me after a small conflict that we have. Not me, my parent, you know, Nano, some disagreements and stuff. But again, I'm always going to be thankful for them. I think it's just...
What you're describing seems to always happen, right?
Yeah.
There's a level where one individual gives a lot of time and effort, and then the player hits a point where it's time to move on. Mm-hmm. The breakup, or whatever you want to call it, of those folks, though, is always, you hope that the coach realizes that what's best for them from here forward is not me, right? And that's hard for coaches to do sometimes. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, no, it's true. And my dad also wasn't an easy person to deal with, you know. So I think it was just the right time to do something different according to the situation, you know, to the context. So I was number one in the nation, and I was hitting balls in front of my house against a wall because I didn't have a place to play. We also didn't have the money to rent a court, you know, so I was just hitting balls against the wall for a couple months until we rented a court in a club near to our house, and there was a coach, you know, working over there that knew me from my tournaments, you know, around in the region. And then he came to me and asked me what I was doing, you know, where are you playing, how is it going? And I told him that I was not playing at the academy anymore, and he said, is there any chance that I can go and talk to your parents? His name is Arturo Gio. It's also one of the angels in my life, you know, one of the people that really helped me. He didn't have to leave the court and go talk to me, you know. He didn't have to go and talk to my parents at all, but he did it. He came to my parents. He went to the house and he said, Reynaldo, I know somebody that could help Joao. You know, there's a group of players. There's a group of very, very good group that is being developed right now by a very nice person there in Chile that is helping these players to develop, you know, older players that are very professionals. So I want to talk to this person and see if maybe he can help Joao. Who knows, you know? So I went and had this meeting with this person. I want to say his name. He doesn't like me to say his name very often, but I also want to help thank him for everything that he has done. He's my friend until now. All my coaches, you know, Rodrigo, Nano, Arturo, and Alfredo Solesi, which is this person that started helping me, you know, paying for my training. I was on a very selected group of players, very good players. You know, we had Camila Silva was number 5 ITF back in the time. We had another players that were 18 years old and already 300 ATP. So Alfredo gave me the chance to join this team. We were also working with Douglas Cordero, which is now a trainer of several top 100 ATPs. He worked with Fognini. He worked with Tim. He worked with the Fruvitovas. He's working right now with Nakashima. So back in the time, he didn't know anything about tennis. He came to Chile, you know, with the mentality to grow, and he started learning and see the movements and creating stuff. And he
but
also
he didn't play tennis or anything.
He didn't play tennis. He was from Cuba. He's from Cuba.
So he's kind of like a Nick Bollettieri type that didn't play but got educated and learned a lot.
Exactly. So he's a fitness guy, you know. So, and he got there always with the motivation and the attitude and champion, you know, and motivating us and learning. And sometimes he will grab a racket and try to hit. But he had the studies. He was he's a very, you know, he got some degrees and very good studies in Cuba about medicine and sports and all that stuff. And he was probably one of the important parts of our success in the group in general. Like, everybody started playing better. We had two coaches from Argentina as well.
What was he doing, though, to make y'all play better? Was it fitness related? Was it nutrition related? What was he doing?
Fitness, nutrition, a little bit of both, but mainly fitness. So I remember this very clearly. We did a preseason of 6 weeks, 2 weeks on the sand in the morning, and the same 2 weeks in the afternoon we'll go to a gym. Then the next 2 weeks we'll go to a hill, you know, and do any kind of sprintings, you know, incline sprints, and then we went to do stuff on the court. So
the sand and the hill probably is pretty self-explanatory. What were y'all doing in the gym? Lifting weights?
Lifting weights. He will be creative as well, you know. He will try to lift weights, but always thinking on tennis movements, you know.
Were they higher rep or lower rep lifting?
I remember it was depends on the moment of the preseason. In the beginning,
good.
Will be
so he was periodizing. He would maybe start heavy and then go light, more rep. It
exactly.
Makes sense.
No, he's a machine at that. He's an expert on that part, and we'll do a lot of sprinting with VO2, you know, with oxygen masks and everything.
Really,
it was a very professional work that he did, and it showed in the physicality of everybody.
Where is he now?
He's in the U.S. He's in Miami. He's in Miami. He's traveling around the world. He's working with the Fruvirtovas sister right now. They are 17 and 18, very young players, you know.
Gotcha.
Before that, working with Nakashima. So sometimes I say hi to him. You know, I try to talk to him to see if he can help me out a little bit, you know, with the players here. And
love it.
So you're there
with him. He's training y'all at the academy.
Yeah.
Keep going. Sorry for interrupting. Keep going with the story.
So I still remember his words because we were on week four of the preseason and I had to play my first tournament of the year. The first tournament of the year in Chile is always very important because the rankings go back to zero. 0 points.
Oh, really? They start over. It's not an annual. They just start right over.
The first 32 can make it into this first tournament, which is like a national. It's not a national championship, but is actually.
Because everybody shows
everybody
up.
Everybody wants to play. You get the contracts right away, you know, if you do well, you know, and everything. So, plus, it's the first tournament before the South American tour. So, everybody goes there.
So, mid October or November, y'all start really training hard to ramp up so that in January you're ready to go.
Exactly. So, I was on week four of the preseason. Then the year before, I was number one playing against all these great players that you see right now, you know, like Garin, Jari. Chile always had very good players. I remember the guys from my age, 95, 94, 96, they won the South American Championship 3 years in a row. And we also won the 14th World Championship. So back in the time, the players of my age were dominating in Chile, were dominating, you know, South America. I remember a lot of players, and some of them play college, like Guillermo Nunez, played for TCU. He's helping Nori sometimes, Cameron Nori.
Sure.
I remember Galleguillos that never got to be the best tennis player, but he beat Monteiro back in the time. You know, Monteiro is playing right now. So we always had very good tennis players in Chile at that age. Very special group of players, you know, 10 or 20 that were incredible good. You will see them play and you will think, these guys, you know, are going to get there, you know. But you know, there's different things that happen in the way. There's a financial part, that is very important. Having the right people to guide you, you know, so.
And even the desire. You see really good players hit 22 years old and they're like, I'm ready to move on to something different.
Yeah, I remember Galleguillo was the most talented person that I have seen in my life, you know. He could hit drop shots and lofts and drop shots and slices and all kind of crazy tweeners and stuff. And so, it was a group of very talented players back in the time. And where were we at?
So you were telling us about you. So you started training with them.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. I started training and then
and you're headed into your January tournament.
We're in week four of the preseason. And I still remember Douglas telling me, muchacho, you call me muchacho, muchachito. Muchacho, yeah, you want to know that you are in week four. You have a lot of loads of work in your body. It's not going to be the best. You're probably going to feel a little bit slow. But trust me, after 2-3 weeks, you're going to feel how everything starts. You start feeling lighter, feeling stronger. But I just wanted to tell you that, you know, go and play because you have to play that tournament. But you're not going to feel the greatest. So, and it was true. I lost in the first round of that tournament. Being a seeded, but from there everything started getting better. Second tournament, the week after, I did a second round, and then the week after a quarterfinal, and then from there it was just finals and winning and finals and winning, until I got back again to top two, top three in the nation. So the work and the words that he said, you know, were true, and yeah. So it was a great team. Everybody was doing well. And
Were you traveling internationally any, or were you mainly staying in Chile?
I was mainly staying in Chile, and I think that's one of the things that one of the reasons why I wasn't improving at the speed of the players that were actually traveling, like Garin and Jari and Maya and all these guys that were going to Europe, play the European tour, and then going to Africa, some of them, and going to Asia, and obviously coming to the US to play the Eddie Hearn and the Orange Bowl. So they will come back stronger year after year, and there got to be a point in 16 where I couldn't beat those guys anymore. And
right. And
some of them were getting, you know, were getting wildcard for challengers and ATPs, and they were winning. So that age is very crucial for a tennis player, I believe. And having the experience to play different game styles, you know, around the world. People, you know, from Europe that play faster, from the U.S. that go and like to do a lot of serve and volley, you know, different surface as well. So I think it's a very important age. But I stay in Chile. I stay playing, you know, winning a lot over there, national championships and stuff. And then I had to take a decision at 16. It was either junior ITFs or professional tournaments, future tournaments. So I think if you have the money, it's always good to do junior ITFs. You know, it's the right way to follow the process because you're playing people from your age. But I didn't have the money, so I had to decide and start playing futures, you know, professional tournaments and fighting the qualies, playing against people that was 26, 24, right. 28, you know, and losing 6-0, 6-0, or losing badly, you know, in the beginning. And then little by little, I started getting confidence, getting a couple wins in, you know. And I got to have my first ATP point when I was 17. After a year of playing future tournaments, you know, I got my first point at 17. And then back in that time, I had Facebook, you know, and I started getting messages in
from
Facebook.
College coaches.
From college. And I have zero idea what college was. In my mind, I'm getting my first point, you know. I'm feeling good. This is the dream. This is what I was fighting for, you know. And from now on, I want to go up. I want to keep improving, keep getting more points. So I had no idea what was college tennis. And University of, you know, Georgia, University of Texas, University of Wisconsin offered me, you know, like full ride and stuff like that. I had no idea. I did a couple of calls or FaceTime with them. They explained me a little bit, but in my head, I just wanted to be a professional, you know. I wanted to get to the top, but also it was very hard because I didn't have the money. I was just talking because I had this dream, you know. I was hoping for something to happen, you know, to find some extra help, you know, because it's really expensive. It's really expensive. So even though
college is a good route because you get 4 free years, right? You get an education. And today, especially, the colleges will even support playing futures and challengers and things like that. I don't know if it was that way back then.
It was. I believe it was that way. I just didn't have the information. You know?
Right.
I didn't know anything. So that was the right decision to take, to go very early, you know, age 17 years old, 18. I finished high school at 18. So
talk about the colleges that you considered and then where you ended up going.
Yeah. So I was playing. I was still playing at 17. I got more ATP points. I got to have a few, 3-4 ATP points. And then I started getting some offers, but I wanted to keep playing, you know. I also played a few ITF tournaments that were in Chile. So I remember this story that is very funny because I got a wildcard to play an ITF tournament in Chile and some of the best juniors were coming, right? And this guy from Mexico, he was ranked 37 in the world, coming from Wimbledon, coming from playing junior queens and all this this European grass tour, and I have to face him in the first round. I see the draw. I had to play this guy in the first round, having no ITF points. I was a wild card, playing against the 37 in the world. And I remember seeing this guy walking into the court with two rackets in his head, in his hands, a water bottle. And I said, there's no way this guy is going to beat me. If he's entering the court with two rackets in his hands and just a water bottle, he doesn't know.
Either that or he's really freaking good.
But I didn't care. Like I always felt better being the underdog and feeling that anger. Like somebody would look at me like, oh, no, this guy is not good enough to beat me.
So he just rolled up in a water bottle and two rackets.
And he didn't know what it was coming, you know. So we started playing. He was lefty. I did a very good good pattern, you know, my backhand down the line, my heavy forehand, you know, to his backhand, and I win the first set. I lose the second set, and we're fighting on the third set with so many people watching, you know, like 200-300 people watching in the court. They couldn't believe what was happening, you know, but they knew me. The people from Chile, they knew me. They knew that I was tough, and they told him before, but he didn't listen, you know. He still walked on the court with two rackets and a water bottle. And I ended up beating him 7-6 in the third. So even though I had 0 points, no ITF points, no ranking, I had the level to be, you know.
So what did the celebration when you hit that final point? Was there a big come on, let's go?
I just look at the two people that had, you know, in my corner, you know, Tony, my Argentinian coach, Tony Kubert, and Walter, that was also there. Just look at them. Even though this tournament was in Chile, most of the people was rooting for this guy, this other guy, you know, because he will train also in Chile sometimes. He was friends with them, and he was a star. So even if it was in my country, these people was kind of rooting
for him.
They couldn't believe what was happening. They were rooting for him, and I just look at my corner and just celebrate, you know.
Give a good fist bump or what?
Yeah. I mean, I exactly don't remember how I celebrate. I just remember a few points of that match and the guy walking in, you know, and
talk me through your pattern real quick. I know that you said that you were playing your backhand down. You're a righty, right?
Yeah.
You were playing your backhand down the line.
Yeah.
To his backhand, and then you were coming inside out, high and heavy to his forehand.
So this is one of my weapons, I think, from the kid. I was always listening to my coaches, and I would always do whatever they told me to do. So I remember Nano telling me this strategy when I used to work with him, saying something that he will call treatment to the backhand. So you're going to make him a treatment to the backhand. You're going to drive this guy crazy. You're going to hit every single ball to the backhand of the player, righty or lefty, you know, and you're going to have a short ball. And when you have the short ball, you're going to go to the backhand again. You know, so you're gonna make him hit only backhands if this is the weakest side, you know, which is right. normally is. So I will do a treatment to the backhand to this player, going backhands down the line, heavy, you know, high backhands down the line. I will go with my forehand cross court, forehands inside in, and whenever I have a short ball, I will mix it up. I will mix it up between going to the backhand of the guy or to the forehand, you know. So I did this all the time. My serves were strictly going to the backhand, a slice or kick. I was surprised a few times, you know, with a flat serve to his forehand, but I just follow a pattern, and I used to follow a pattern when I play so strict, you know, that will make me be a very consistent player.
But what happens when he starts sliding out trying to run around it? Now are you having to adjust? I mean, it surely he adjusted some in that match.
He adjusted, but I think my footwork was probably one of my biggest strengths. I was somebody very fast. I played soccer until I was 12, 11 years old, I'm going to say. And also, I always remember my dad telling me, you know, to bounce on my feet, bounce on my feet. He will only tell me a few things, you know. He didn't know anything about tennis. He will tell me about bouncing on my feet and breathing. Bouncing on my feet and breathe. Bouncing on your feet and breathe. So I had those words from 8 years old in my head all the time, that at the end, just by the fact of bouncing on my feet, my footwork became very good.
Well, and most people, when they get nervous, the feet get still.
Yeah.
So it is good. I mean, it's good advice. It's simple.
It's very simple.
But a lot of people forget about it.
It's fundamentals. I think the best coaches in the world, they tell you, you know, like fundamentals and basics are one of the most important things. You know,
yeah.
Sometimes we look at the strategy and hit a ball here, hit a ball there, and do this and do that. You know, hit three balls there, then
but
one ball
really
here.
It's a really simple game.
But at the end, the most basic stuff are the most helpful, and at the end, those things are going to help you to stay in the present.
Right,
you know,
right.
Move your feet. I'm just thinking of moving my feet, you know. Breathe. I'm not thinking on the scenario. I'm thinking on moving, breathing, relaxing, you know. So at the end, those things really helped me to be in on the present, to develop my footwork, you know. And I was always somebody that would move very well on the court. And I had no problem hitting my forehand from everywhere.
Right.
You know?
So tell us about college then. You played that match.
Yeah, so I played that match, and then I got injured in a very important moment of my career, you know. Back in the time, we were going to have 15 future tournaments. 15 future tournaments in Chile. It was the best moment of my career.
In 1 year?
In 1 year, yes.
Wow.
In 1 year. Not even in 1 year, yeah. And it was going to be like 9 in a row. So it was something crazy. Something that you only see these days in Argentina or Brazil, you know. So I was ready for it, you know. I had 3 ATP points. I was 17. I was expecting, you know, to break through in these tournaments, to maybe get to a semis or a final or quarters, start getting more points, you know. And I had a wrist injury. I changed my racket to a racket that was 10 or 15 grams heavier. No, I'm lying. I remember how it was. So I changed to a different racket from Pure Drive to Pure Strike. And I'm playing this first round of quali in the first tournament, and I started losing against somebody that I shouldn't be able to lose. I shouldn't be losing, right? And I see this kid that used my same racket, and I asked him, and I said, "Hey, do you mind if I borrow your racket? Like, I cannot make a ball with this racket."
But it was heavier.
It was heavier. So it was a 10 gram heavier racket, a Roddick Pure Drive. You know, I used the regular Pure Drive, and I play. I win 6-1, 6-0 the next two sets. And I didn't feel anything. The next round, I went 2-2. You know, I started feeling a little bit of something on my wrist, but I didn't care, you know. Third match of the quali, I'm playing with an important pain, asking what is this, you know. And I go into the fourth day, main draw, first round. I wake up in the morning and I couldn't hold my phone. Like, it was so bad that I couldn't even hold my own phone to send a text. So
wow.
I go on and start warming up, and I couldn't hold my racket for the forehand side. I couldn't believe it. And I didn't have that many chances to play a main draw of a future. So that was like, I have to play. I can't believe it. Oh, I'm going to slice the ball. I'm going to do whatever, but I'm going to play, you know. So I played, and it was impossible. You know, every time I would hit the ball, it would hurt. And it ended up being an injury that took me 6 months to 8 months to come back from. And
what was it?
It was a stress fracture in one of the small bones of the wrist.
Yeah, they say there's three times when players get injured. When they change equipment is one of them. The intensity of the practice or the amount of hours, right? Those three things are where injuries happen.
Yeah.
And so I always discourage kids, don't borrow a friend's racket.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's so the frame, the string, all of that is a chance to get hurt.
Exactly.
And 10 grams sounds like it's nothing, but when you're hitting 500 balls in a match, it adds up.
Yes. And if your body is not physically ready, your wrists are not strong, you know, not ready to take this weight, then stuff like this can happen. That's why I always recommend the players, you know, if they want to move up in weight, do it five grams.
Oh yeah.
Make sure that you're working out, that you're doing, you know, some extra stuff for your arms, for your wrists, you know, and then go 5x5. I know it's an extra, you know, investment because you have to buy more rackets, you know.
Well, some people will take the butt cap off and put like hot glue in there and
exactly.
go up 3-4 grams
yeah,
at a time.
That's something very smart. Yeah, yeah. So I always encourage them to, if you're going to change or go up, I agree, you're getting stronger, you're getting older, you know, you need a heavier racket, but go slowly 5x5 because otherwise that injury, you know, it was a break point in my career. I could have. We never know what would have happened. You know, maybe I wouldn't done very good, or maybe I would have. But being 8 months out of the courts, trying to get my tennis back, I think my confidence back in my forehand, it was something that I am not gonna give it to anybody. I will not give it to anybody.
Yeah.
You know, so it could have been avoided if I would have talked first. If I would have talked to my coach. If at the very first moment of feeling something on my hand, I would have stopped or get advice, you know. But I was so, like, resistant to pain, and, like, nothing would stop me, that I just kept going until I actually couldn't hold my racket or my phone.
Yeah, you got determined. And it happens to a lot of players. I mean, it is what it is. So you come back and you decide, you know, I'm going to go play college.
Exactly. So then I started looking at the messages again, you know, who are these people? All right, maybe this is a good option, you know, having the my feet on the earth, you know, I don't have the money. I lost an opportunity right there. You know, I need to get my tennis back. And this is an important age of my life. So I'm 18, I'm going to be 19, you know. This could not be a bad option. You know, I started getting advice from people and they said, I think it's the best for
go
you.
Try
you know,
it, yeah.
You're gonna get a college degree, you know, and everything. So I started looking at these messages, and the offers were not the same because I didn't have the points anymore. I was a year older as well, and I started looking at all the colleges, and I decided to go to UT San Antonio, University of Texas in San Antonio, UTSA.
Sure.
I went there not knowing how to speak English at all. So I had 14 years of English at a school. I had all A's in English.
But it's very different from actually showing up.
When you get to the reality, you know that you're not even close. You cannot understand anything, you know. It's not a recording anymore. It's not somebody talking slow anymore. Somebody talking to you in a real conversation, very fast. So
you flew out of Chile. Where'd you land here? Dallas?
I believe in Dallas, and then from Dallas to San Antonio. Yeah.
And so who picked you up?
The coach, Jeff Cater, that I saw him last year in Kalamazoo, this tournament. We took a picture together, you know, Jeff. And then also a Spanish teammate, Joel.
Which was great because now you have somebody you can talk to.
Exactly.
So, and even though the accent's a little different from Spain to Chile, at least you have somebody you can communicate with. So he picks you up at the airport, and what, does he drive you to the dorm, and what's he do?
We went to lunch together, and we start talking, and Jeff is trying to talk to me, but I cannot understand anything. Jeff, I'm sorry if you expected to.
Could your Spanish teammate understand him?
Yes.
So he was having to translate.
Exactly. So he was already his third year in the school. So he was good with English, you know. Yeah. But Jeff was expecting me to speak a little bit of English, you know. But no, it wasn't the case. So and on top of that, I start living with him, with the Spanish guy, you know, with a guy from Puerto Rico and an American. So we're all speaking Spanish.
So now you're speaking Spanish at home. Yeah.
Oh, my God. So it took me, I'm going to say, the first 6 months, the first semester, I learned zero English, you know. I was in English classes again, but I didn't think the same thing, you know, in Chile. I wasn't talking English that much. I wasn't using my survival instinct as much, you know. Like, I have to speak. I think I started learning when I had to speak in order to survive, to get food, you know, to pay my stuff or to do things that were necessary, you know, that I couldn't get away from. So my second semester, I started learning. But yeah, college was an amazing experience. I remember before getting to college, I did a preseason with Fernando Gonzalez. He was a coach already. He's a legend from Chile, top five in the world, and Olympic champion as well. So he was coaching this guy, Giraldo, 30 in the world. And they invite me to a preseason together because they were going to do it in this in Alfredo's house, you know. So I was hitting with him all the time for an entire month. And his girlfriend back in the time, Sorana Cirstea, that is still playing, she's like 30 right now. So I was hitting with them for an entire month, you know, doing this preseason. It was an amazing experience, you know, share court with Gonzalez, somebody that I grew up watching, waking up at 4 in the morning to watch his matches and all that stuff. And I came to college, you know, after I got to San Antonio. 2 days after, I was playing my first match. And I had no idea of how everything, you know, would
most
go.
Most foreign players, when they come, are surprised at the level of college tennis. Were you surprised by it? Was it higher than you expected or no?
Actually, I'm going to say I was playing line five. So Jeff put me there as a strategical move, I'm going to say. So all the people that I was playing, I wasn't surprised at their level. It were pretty close matches.
Right.
But obviously, when I would look at line one, you know, it would be a difference. I want to say all those line one guys had the level of 300, 400, 500 ATP, you know. So, yeah, in my position, I think all the matches were close and the level was good, but nothing, you know, crazy. I managed to do well my first year, even though it took me... I started my season going 1-4, and then from 1-4 I went 10-4, you know. I won the next, like, 9 matches. In those months also, I had a tragic, you know, message from home. My dad passed away. And then I think from there, it was definitely... I had an angel, you know, in the sky, and I started playing for him, and I also felt, like, motivated, you know, to do well. Obviously, it wasn't an easy new to digest, you know, being far from home.
Sure.
I had to fly back, actually, because he had cancer, so I had to fly back and see how he was, you know. This was finishing my first year. We did amazing, by the way. We did amazing. We were the best team in the history of the UTSA until... this year or past year, I think the guys did amazing. They're like top 25 or something like that.
Yeah, they're having a good season for sure.
So I had to go back. I had to see my dad and all this stuff. I came back to the U.S. Jeff is leaving, and we did so well that he found his dream job. You know,
where did he go?
Oh man, I always have trouble remembering, but I know it's it's there, Green.
Yeah, we can look it up.
And they're very smart.
So he got you.
I don't remember, but I can't remember exactly.
He left and got a new coach.
Yeah, we got a new coach from Brazil, and it was different. I also start feeling a little bit of pain in my wrist again. This guy didn't know us at all, you know. So he came with the mentality to build, I think, his own team, and we were not responding well to him as well. So I think we just didn't get along. You know, the team, the entire team and the coach. And that's why you know, after a year, out of the 13 guys, only two stayed and 11 were not there anymore, you know. So after that semester that I didn't do very well, I had some injury in my wrist as well. Low confidence, you know. It wasn't the family that I used to be, you know. I fail a couple of classes as well. I get distracted. I fail a couple of classes, and I ended up in the position where I had to take summer classes to keep my eligibility. And the coach told me, like, I'm only gonna have a 50% scholarship for you, or 30%. And for me, that was crazy. You know, I wasn't gonna be able to afford $25,000, you know, to stay in the U.S.
Sure.
So with no time to, I didn't know the rules about, you know, about the NCAA, all that stuff. I didn't have the time to transfer on time, and I decided that the best was going back to Chile. So I finished my college career in the U.S. after two semesters, you know, after four semesters, 2 years, two seasons, you know. And then I had to start all over again in Chile, you know.
And so how did you make it to the academy here, Tucker Tennis Academy?
How did I make it to the academy? I made it because of one of my teammates, Tomás Stillman, was working here. And I started, when I gone back to Chile, I started, you know, working as a coach. Well, I started working very early to pay for my stuff. 17 years old.
Sure.
I started working as a coach, you know, helping my coaches and
but
having
Tomás
my own lessons.
But Tomás reached out to you.
Tomás reached out to me, and I was finishing my degree, you know. I had to finish my degree. I started all over in Chile. So I was studying finance in the U.S. And I started physical education in Chile, something that I liked. More finance, it wasn't my thing, you know. I liked more the sport related, how to understand the body, the psychology, you
sure.
know. So it really helped me to complement my coaching career, having all this these studies, you know, all these all these classes, and I really liked it. And by my last semester, well, Tomás always talked to me every year, you know, we need coaches, we want you here, you know, I wish you could come with us. And by my last semester, I said, I think I'm ready, you know. I think I'm ready to go. I feel like I have something pendant with the U.S. Always the people treat me very well here. When I was studying, when I was in college, you know, they were super nice to me, you know. They always told me to come back. So I felt like I felt great in the U.S. And I always had the feeling like I had to come here to keep developing and following my dream, you know. Even it wasn't a dream as a player anymore, but as a coach. So,
well, you get a chance to pay it back. You had so many coaches help you. Now you get a chance to help some other players.
Yeah. So you know? I got here on May 2022. But sadly, before arriving, look at my life, man. It's amazing. Before getting here, Matias Marin calls me, the director back in the time of Tucker. And he says, Joao, I want you to be the first one to hear this from. Tomás is not going to be with us anymore. But we really want you to come
to
here,
come,
you know,
yeah.
And we understand if you don't want to come because Tomás was, you know, something important and why you took the decision or whatever. And I said, Matias, I need 1 minute, 5 minutes to digest this. I don't want to give you an answer right now, but if you need me to, I'm going to say I'm going because this is my future, you know, this is what I want. But I need 5 minutes to digest this and I'll call you back, you know. So I call him back and I say, I want this, you know, not because of Tomás, not because of anybody. I really want this for myself and for my career, and this is the best decision for me. So count me in.
So you came. So that what an amazing junior career and a story. And it's really important for people to hear all the different backgrounds of ways that players get into tennis. And what their careers look like. So I want to thank you for being here. We'll wrap it up with a fast feed, but it's clear that we need to do a second episode where we talk. So we talked about your playing career. I'd love to do one where we talk about your coaching career and some of your coaching philosophies and thoughts and things that you've learned.
Sure.
But while you were a player,
yes,
tell us what these are quick answer questions. Your go-to restaurant when you're on the road, whether you're a coach, a player.
Olive Garden. Simple,
okay.
And good.
Most used app on your phone?
Most used app, Instagram.
Instagram, not WhatsApp. Most people say WhatsApp.
Instagram, yeah.
Who was your biggest rival when you were playing in Chile as a kid? Either it could be from 10 to 16, 17 years old. Biggest rival?
Sebastian Peñalosa.
Nice.
Rest in peace, Sebastian.
What racket do you play with right now?
I use different rackets, but I really like the Wilson Ultra.
Okay, Wilson Ultra. And what weight?
300
grams. Yes. What tension?
55.
String?
Luxilon.
And what grip size?
Grip 3.
Okay, so like 4 3/8. 4 3/8. Okay. Favorite tennis movie or documentary?
Ooh, that's a good one. Tennis movie.
And it could be in any language. Doesn't matter the language.
I think there was this movie called Wimbledon. Have you ever heard from it?
Yeah, yeah.
I think that was one of my favorites. And one of the books, one of my favorite books is probably Open of Agassi.
Oh, that is a good one. That is a really good one. I agree with you. If you could pick any current pro to play a pro tournament with in doubles, who would it be?
I have to say Federer. Even though he's not in the tour anymore, he's a legend. He was my idol when I grew up, along with my Chilean, you know, like pro players, you know, Masu and Gonzalez. But I always look at Federer, and for me, if I ever have the chance, I watch him play in Chilean exhibition. But if I had the chance to shake his hand or like share a court with him, it would be unbelievable.
It would be a blast, Federer. Yeah. Anything about your junior career you wish you had done different?
This is a very good question. I'm gonna say keep dreaming, work hard, be smart, but also understand, you know, the process and the limitations, you know, see the big picture of everything and try to take the best decision, you know. I think I don't think anything that I did was a mistake. I think you learn from anything, but I'm gonna say I could have done better at taking a decision earlier, maybe in my career, you know, of coming and play college tennis and maybe go to a better school, you know, and seeing it more like a way to keep developing my professional career and I still have the dream alive. I felt like when I came to college and the mentality that I had is I'm going to college to play some tennis, you know, I felt like my dream to becoming a professional tennis player by coming to the U.S. to play college, it was going to be, you know, done. So
yeah, that 6 to 8 months off because of the injury probably really changed the mentality.
But it wasn't the right thing. I just didn't know anything about college tennis. I didn't know that actually that's the best step, you know, if you want to go pro.
It's a really good step, yeah.
For me, I think it's the best for all the people that is normal, you know, like that are not superstars, like Ben Shelton or Alcaraz, those guys.
But even,
you know,
Ben Shelton played at Florida.
Exactly. He went there. He lived the experience. He saw it by himself, and then he started playing pro. So I think I could have gone to college a little bit earlier, you know, but I also don't regret how things happen, and I think I learned from everything, and my goal is just to share this with my students and trying to help them, you know, to take the best decisions.
It's a great story, and I think I can't wait for the kids here at the academy to listen to it. They actually do listen to this more than
do?
You would think, yeah. And can't wait for them to hear it, because I think also as a player, it's easier to receive coaching when you understand the background of the coach that you are being coached by. So thanks so much for being here. It was awesome, and can't wait to do a second version of this.
Thank you, Robert, for sure. Yeah, just let me know, and we'll be back at it.